Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Adam. That
Hi.
was my.
That's okay. Well, here we are back again on this exploration of what tatrionics can explain and how it all connects everything up. And I have a interesting question which comes down in two words
Okay.
which are the basis of a lot of confusion. And these are the two words: gravitation and graviton.
Right. You're right, those cause a lot of confusion. Yeah, a succinct answer would be that the graviton doesn't exist, but I know that'll upset some of our physics
Go for
students
it.
out
Go
there.
for it.
And it's one of these things. Again, the graviton came out purely out of a mathematical need to rationalize or to bring symmetry back into equations, maths equations in particular. Again, top down versus bottom up. How do I address this? When gravity was first formulated by Isaac Newton, he noted that one of its properties was that it was a strictly convergent force. That is, it only ever created an attraction. You don't have repulsive gravity. As much as we would like to have repulsive gravity, it doesn't exist. The gravity only, matter only attracts other matter, doesn't repel it. So when it was formulated mathematically, you ended up with a minus sign to indicate that it was strictly convergent. As we developed an understanding of charge, Coulomb's charge, as in opposites attract, similars repel, which strangely enough has the same mathematical form as Newton's formulation for gravity, and again that's covered in my fourth book on quantum cosmology. It quickly becomes apparent that we have a thing called an electromagnetic field, which is made up of photons. Photons of energy spread out in two directions. Again, what I'm about to discuss isn't widely known in modern physics, but what I can do using Planck's quanta and equilateral geometry is build photons from the ground up to match and to create electromagnetic fields that match the formulation of Einstein's EM tensors and explain the mechanics behind Coulomb's law of opposites of attraction. And it's done via the energy momenta of the photons, i.e., the scalar equilateral energy comes together, opposites attract, plus and minus, to form a neutral photon, which is a diamond shape in tetrionics. So you have a diamond, a neutral diamond, made up of plus and minus Planck charges. The formula for electromagnetic fields is E equals HF. So, if you have a frequency of, say, 1,000 in an EM wave, you have 1,000 photons, plus and minus. This again highlights a problem using a mathematical approach, which was quickly evident, and that was the formulation of Planck's constant for heat law with Einstein's formulation for the same thing using photons. If you look into my QM, yeah, I think, yeah, into the QM, and it may be repeated again in the QED handbooks, ebooks, you'll see that mathematically equating E, oh, sorry, Planck's formula compared to Einstein's formula for energy, an electromagnetic wave, gives the equation H nu equals E equals HF, which is mathematically equivalent to saying 1 equals 2 or odds equals evens. It was incorrect, and it's corrected in my work, and the upshot of it is that we have two Planck quanta, or i.e., 2 H nu equals E equals HF for electromagnetic waves. Now, these two Planck quanta with their linear momentum causes the energy of light to radiate in two directions from its source, You radiate in the positive direction and you radiate in the negative direction from its source, which is why we have reflectors and torches and things like that. You put the reflector so you catch the light going the opposite way and turn it about to go the same way that you want the torch to shine. With that formulation for electromagnetic waves, if you want to create a graviton that is purely convergent instead of radiating outwards in both directions, you need a wave that radiates inwards to the source. So you have to turn the linear momenta 180 degrees about and face it the other way. Geometrically, you can't do it. Hence my opening statement that gravitons do not exist. The arrow or the vector direction of linear momentum in all Planck quanta starts at the block wall or the null point singularity of the magnetic dipole and points outward to the E field apex. It does not go from the E field apex and point to the magnetic dipole. So gravitons, as they're mathematically formulated to meet the needs of both relativity and Newton's formulations, do not exist in physicality and tetrionics. That having been said, obviously we still need something akin to the electromagnetic wave to explain gravitation, which is strictly convergent. What it turns out to be, the secret, and again this took months and months of thinking and working through, turns out that gravitation, or convergent universal gravitation as we know it, is not the result of a singular force. It is in fact the result of three forces, a mixture of convergent and divergent forces. We've already just discussed that we have photons that radiate out in both directions from any source. What we haven't discussed is what the sources are. Obviously, in the case of gravity, we have mathematically in physics today, we have point sources. We show them in tetrionics not to exist. What we have is the minimum quanta of matter being a tetrion, which is a tetrahedral shape made up of four charges. The key to gravitation is this. Universal gravitation is a process whereby matter creates a gravity force. It also has associated with it all matter form radiates EM energy. Any atom, once it's created, will always have an associated electromagnetic field unless it's at absolute zero. At that point, there is no chem field, as I call it, no kinetic EM field. It's purely just a standing wave of matter. But ignoring that, because very few things are at absolute zero, the moment a piece of matter is created, two things happen. One is mass energies, the equilateral triangles that we've spoken about, fold up into tetrions, which are standing waves of energy where energy, mass energy circulates in the tetrahedral topology. It's now a topology, not a geometry. The geometry is the triangular faces, but the overall shape of the atom or the tetrion upwards or matter is the topology. And there's a distinct difference that modern science doesn't make, or modern physics doesn't make. Modern physics treats it all as energy under Einstein's E equals mc squared equivalency, forgets to define matter properly, and just terms everything in terms of pressure density in a stress energy thing, which is where you get curved space-time. That's not quite what's happening. What's happening is charge in mass energy is creating a 3D matter topology, and they have charges just like protons are different charges to electrons. They have different shapes made up of different numbers of things. They have different masses, different amount of triangles in those topologies. But that topology, when it forms, displaces the energy that's in free space. All energy radiates out in through free space, filling it just like water in a bathtub, but not as dense, very, very fine, not even like mist, really fine. But there is energy in space. When a tetrion forms, or any matter forms, it creates the standing wave of mass energy that excludes or displaces some of that vacuum energy. Think of it as a deflated beach ball is in the swimming pool. It makes very little difference to the swimming pool. But if you inflate that beach ball, it blows up, becomes a topology that displaces water. When it does that, the water pushes back, trying to get rid of that, to try to collapse the beach ball. I'm trying to make this as simple as I can as I go through without getting complex. That vacuum energy, or the water equivalence, pushing back is what I term gravitational matter. That's the gravity. That's not gravitation. It is strictly gravity created by matter. Gravitational matter, aside from this gravity that it creates when it's formed, also has these electromagnetic fields that we spoke about. Whether it's energy of motion, energy of heat, energy of color, spectral lines, all those mass energies of kinetic motion form EM fields around matter. Those EM fields, which are described by Coulomb's law, remember its formulation is almost identical to Newton's formulation for gravity, except it's got a different scaling constant and it works in two directions instead of one. It's that EM wave can attract objects via the charge, another object. Remember, all matter is made up of charges, so one object of matter can attract another object of matter. Equally, similar charges within that matter can repel. So you get this force from the electromagnetic field that extends out from the matter itself that creates a field of interaction, as I call it, where you get convergent and divergent forces. Electromagnetic fields want to spread out from the matter out into space to form the vacuum energies. Gravity itself is formed when matter inflates or is formed. When you fold mass energy into its tetrahedral shapes to create matter, you displace a volume of vacuum energy, which creates a convergent force. So now you've got three forces once you've created any piece of matter in the universe. You have the strictly convergent force of vacuum energies trying to fill up the inside of the sphere, inside of the topology. It's a very, very, very weak force because it's the vacuum energy trying to equalize the volume. And it's passive and it only works in one direction. It is only pushing inward to try and collapse the matter topology, which you can't do because tetrahedrons are one of the strongest shapes possible. And the amount of quanta of mass energy in matter vastly outweighs that of vacuum energies, vastly. So it's a very, very weak force. Interestingly, because it's the vacuum energy pushing in on the matter, it does not create a gravity wave as posited in Einstein's formulation. What creates a wave is the electromagnetic wave around the matter, which works in both directions because it's plus and minus Planck quanta. Some point inwards, some point outwards, depending on whether it's a positive charge field or a negative charge field, or whether it's a charged object or an uncharged object of matter. These all have an effect on what the EM field does. Here's where we have a slight... Now that we know that gravitation, universal gravitation, is the result of gravity pushing inwards plus electromagnetic fields operating in two directions, it creates, those three fields create a net force. Now remember, I keep saying that modern physics is modeled using mathematics on observation. Newton, when he formed his law of gravity, looked at the way the stars moved, plotted the acceleration curves, and worked out his formula for gravitation. It has no input in there. There's no accounting for time. According to Newton, gravity acts instantly everywhere in the universe, all at once. If you were to take the sun away from the solar system, the Earth would know immediately. Einstein came along and set the speed of light as the fastest possible speed. We discussed in the previous discussion on radiation that Einstein also completely ignored longitudinal waves and focused on transverse waves in his photoelectric effect, and to agree with Maxwell's equations. So out of that, not only did he develop the photoelectric effect, but he also developed special relativity, which accounts for the electrodynamics of charged bodies, or matter in general, in motion, and specifically aims at trying to explain inertia. Tetrionics explains inertia, as we've discussed before. It also shows that all matter is made up of charges. So matter, however you look at it, is just a charged object moving in space. Special relativity describes the effects of that motion and how the energy is changed. And for reasons I won't get into here, it is wrong. Well, the math is right, but the assumptions behind what is going on, the mechanics, is wrong. Suffice to say, at this stage, special relativity applies only to EM fields, or the energy momenta inside EM fields of objects in motion. Matter itself is not Lorentz corrected for velocity. It does not contract. You often hear how a train moving at close to the speed of light will be squashed so that it's only a centimeter in size. That does not happen. Tetrionics shows that a train traveling at near or at the speed of light has exactly the same dimensions as it has now. What changes is the energy content of the chem field. You need more energy in that field of motion to make it go the speed of light. So you push more energy into this equilateral field, and that in turn means that the triangles have to be squashed in, and it's the triangles of the chem field, of the mass energy of the chem fields, that contracts, not the matter itself. That's discussed further in throughout my work. But suffice to say, Einstein's special relativity only applies to electromagnetic fields, and that's what we have around matter. So when he developed general relativity, he had a problem. In his equations, he could correct for the perihelion of Mercury that Newton got wrong through the observations, and bearing in mind it's just an observational error. It was only discovered later on after Newton that there was this error in the orbit that Einstein developed relativity to correct for, and he developed general relativity from special relativity. What I'm in effect saying is that even general relativity, whilst correct mathematically, is explained completely wrong with this idea of curved space-time. That's completely erroneous. What in fact is happening with the mathematics of general relativity is that Einstein is looking at mass and matter as energy. And the bending of starlight by gravity is in fact a photon of electromagnetic energy being bent by the EM field of a sun. It's the EM field bending the photon, not the gravity, because EM photons are made up of mass energy. They're not affected by gravity. For gravity to be created and to work, you need a topology. Photons are flat sheets of energy momenta. So by having this model now where we have a topology creating convergent gravity, as well as creating an electromagnetic field that pushes and pulls objects depending on their charge within them, we can now explain general relativity. We can completely get rid of the graviton because we no longer have a problem with instantaneous action at a distance, because the light that stars create are the result of EM pinches, which are electrical discharges, spark gaps. They're longitudinal waves, and they create these long rods or pool cues of energy momenta that push on the planets at all of the time. If you collapse or remove the star, then that momenta chain is broken. The pool cue no longer has something pushing on it, and the Earth will react immediately. The transmission of electromagnetic waves still occurs at the speed of light as per relativity, but we no longer have gravitational waves, and we no longer have gravitons. They're no longer required by theory. So we've united Planck's theory, quantum theory, through the triangles for electromagnetic waves and to form matter. We've explained Newton's instantaneous action at a distance. We've explained what gravity really is, and that is three forces caused by matter topology, as well as mass energy geometries with EM fields. And as a bonus, we also get to explain why Newton's formulation for gravity looks so similar to Coulomb's formulation for charged particles, because they're one and the same formula. Matter is made up of charged particles. The only difference is the strength of the scaling constant between the two. EM fields are many orders of magnitude, or have many orders of magnitude more in them than matter has, and matter to create gravity is simply a displacement. So you won't have gravity waves per se, but you will have instantaneous action at a distance, and you will get universal gravitation wherever matter is formed. All of this, of course, leads to how the stars work in reality instead of through this model of fusion, and that's another discussion in itself. But to sum up your question, Otto, the difference between gravitation and gravitons is that gravitons don't exist, and gravitation is the net observed motion of matter, where the matter topology itself creates a force that's strictly convergent, and the EM fields of that matter, be it an atom or a star or a galaxy, creates an electromagnetic field around it that both pushes and pulls, in addition to gravity, in addition to pure gravity created by matter. This push and pull of the electromagnetic field also explains the radial velocity of stars in galaxies, which currently has to be explained through dark matter and dark energy. In this same process, we explain dark matter and dark energy as simply being a function of electromagnetic fields in space. And then, again, correcting modern physics. Mm-hmm. Was there anything else you needed added or elaborated on?
Well, I'm glad we recorded all this, because
these are the deep, heady comments where I often get people in physics that come across my theory and they say, looks great, this looks fantastic, what's it tell me about gravity? They're sort of jumping into this depth of understanding when my first instinct is to tell them to stop, go back and do quantum mechanics first and get a handle on mass and matter and equilateral energy and things like that first, because in all honesty, as you've heard just now, I do a lot of modern physics is wrong, relativity is right but wrong, the math is right but his ideas are wrong, all through gravity. And if you don't understand the basics of mass and energy, It could be quite easy to walk away shaking your head saying, this guy is just making it up on the fly.
Yeah, I'm really glad that we recorded all this. And I do hope that you will correct the impromptu notes that I made while you were speaking, because at times I had some difficulty catching up, because there is this level where openness to listening is the only way to capture it, which is always the only way to capture new ideas anyhow.
But
in writing, of course, I have to use existing words. And sometimes I see that my mind actually needs other words than the ones we traditionally use. But I hope
mine does that even if I use it.
Yeah.
My fingers often type words and whole sentences that I wasn't really focusing on when I put my fingers to the work. So not to worry, but there's a lot. When I first realized that I had the theory nutted out and basics in my head and then got the revisions done, I've often thought the best way to get Tetrionics out there is to just get a auditorium full of scholars, students and professors, the whole lot, and start at the beginning. Work my way through over a week or two and just explain it slide by slide, how it all fits together. Because it's a university course in itself, and in all honesty, I don't expect people to just dive into gravity and go, oh, this is the answer to everything. It takes a bit to absorb everything that I'm saying.
I'm really glad that all of it starts to fall in place, and in a way that's what we already discussed that would be possible in the Holoversity, that you just collect discourses like these and record them and make them available, that basically, if everybody who asked you questions like I do, and everybody took note why you explain like I try to do, then the whole course would write itself. Need to do is to spontaneously respond to the questions which are given, and they write out the answer so that everybody else can have access to it too.
And even if there was just a group of students writing down questions like you're doing now, and we just posted an area, an open forum, where those questions could be listed, and we could then sit down and do exactly what we're doing now and tackle the questions one by one and just explode or expand on the current discussions that are going on at present from other people's ideas, what questions they want answered and what things they want explained, and then other students could come back and then look that up and go, well, here's a discussion that was already done on gravitons, so we've already got that, that's the one I'm after, and they could sit and listen to that.
In the Holoversity, that's the whole purpose of the Holoversity, to provide that. And coming back to the gravity and graviton question, of course I knew I was going to step right in the middle of the wasp nest or in the whirlpool of creation, because gravity and graviton is basically the essence where you show that Tetrionics does provide a different approach, basically because we need to think in multiple dimensions. I'm really glad that in the past I ran into dimensional analysis, which is a mathematical technique to be able to scale engineering models between different sizes. So if you want to understand how to build a mammoth tanker which has not yet been created, then you can start thinking about a small scale model to get the ideas in place. But in dimensional analysis, there is a very fundamental concept, which is that when you do the scaling technique, which is mathematically very simple and it involves dimensionless numbers, then the computation of that dimensional number is based on the parameters that the scientist, the engineer, inputs into that computation. If you add something or you leave away part of those parameters that describe the situation, you will run into a dimensional parameter which is different.
And the dimensionless
parameters are like the number of Struhal, the number of Mach, the number of Weber, and so on.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what happens presently with the mathematical approach to gravity and quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Both models, both you've got Newtonian gravity, you've got general relativity, which both describe the same thing, the same motions, but are completely different formulations, right? So there's obviously something different at work there that they don't understand. And we've also got quantum mechanics, which doesn't gel with either of them. So when you try and bring them all together, you end up with infinities and all sorts of problems. You end up with a case where you can't add them in because general relativity has a time constant. Newtonian gravity concerns matter, which general relativity doesn't talk about. It just says, well, Einstein basically, and he admits in his latter life, he says, I don't know the difference between mass and matter. I just treat it all as energy. So at the most fundamental physics level, they don't agree with each other, yet we know that the underlying physics works and happens every day without the aid of supercomputers. And then you throw into the mix, as I pointed out, the similarity between Newton's gravity and Coulomb's charge force interaction law, and you can see that there's got to be a common basis there somewhere. I'm just forever grateful that in my lifetime I stumbled across an equilateral triangle because it made, in the long run, despite a lot of brain cells being killed along the way, it allowed me to unify it all. But I had to throw out, like I said, a lot of what I'd learnt in the process and really let the geometry lead the way. And at its heart, I suppose you could describe tetrionics as just a form of analytical geometry. It just puts the scaling. We now have the ability to build a scaled model of any element that we choose on the benchtop. And it's topologically identical to what's happening at the quantum level, where we'll never see it. And it's just a matter of changing the scaling that goes with it, like you're saying. And that the only way that we could do that is through geometry. In mathematics, you just give it a K instead of a G, but in reality, it's just an equilateral triangle of a different size.
Yeah, and that, I think, is essential for this understanding of gravity and the lack of the graviton. Because, let me put it this way, in the approach of science, we see the same as we see in the starting up of biology. When the first cell, the zygote, grows, it grows in pulsations. It extends out and then it collapses a bit, and then it extends out a bit further and collapses a bit. Every time when we do this process of sciencing, we extend our understanding, but at some point we need this collapse to comprehension, which is essentially what tetrionics does. A lot has been created of insights in all different directions. And then, at the same as the process of cell division, the dynamic turns back in for a moment and compresses it so that it can become more coherent and a better basis for continued growth. In what you're doing with tetrionics for all the many aspects of science that have been put in place over the last century is basically to give a trellis in which it can all hang together and show its coherent form. But the trellis is based on a change of dimension. One of the pictures which is necessary in this perspective is that a lot of what people look at is actually a moving film of ongoing creation. Yeah. But what people are shown is the movie of the process taken from a specific perspective, which is called the scientific perspective. But what the textbooks describe is the photograph taken from that movie. And what we see specifically in that in the context of gravity is that it really does matter in which dimension you are looking. And earlier you already explained that if children in school learn to play with triangles and then discover that they can make tetrahedra, then they will know that there's a difference between what happens on the table and what can build up out of that plane. And in what you described for gravity now, there is this fundamental difference between matter and mass and energy, as you continuously point out in all your descriptions. But the most important aspect of it, that it operates in different dimensions. In the end of your story, explanations came back at what happens when a photon moves around a star. And the interpretation that would be a gravity of the star which does the job, as opposed to the electromagnetic field which does the change of the dynamic. It's a fundamental difference in understanding. If you don't see that electricity is different from gravity, then you can also not see that the equation for electricity is different from the equation of gravity. As you started, right at the start you said, the equations look the same, but they're not. And once you see that's in different dimensions, then of course everything falls in place. So at some point, I reckon that it would be very nice to extend on that difference in dimensions, because in your story now you use that as the fundamental key to explain it all, but many people are not familiar with that. So if that's okay with you, at some point, but in this case, I would prefer not to spring it onto you as one of those surprise questions that we've been doing now. But rather that in a way, from your side, you'll probably have a topic in which, in tetrionics, you can see how this change in dimensions is very important. Because in that way we can then take on this topic of the dimensional differences in such a way that it immediately connects up with everything else what tetrionic represents.
We could do a full discussion on space and time coordinates, which is, I think, very important, how it relates to C squared and C to the fourth in relativity, because that's key, because we have to separate space and time, so we no longer talk about space-time. And in doing so, it'll help people get a real grounding for the difference between mass and matter and topology and geometry and Cartesian coordinates and relativistic coordinates. It gels all of that, but it's as you say, it's a topic unto itself. It's like everything else in tetrionics. I take the familiar, pull it apart, and show people what's really going on, like a magician does. Here's the empty hat, and here's the bunch of flowers at the end, all pretty colors.
Yeah. There are a couple of topics which I have been working on, and I would really like to bounce them off you to see how that would look when you look at this from the perspective of tetrionics. And one of my fundamental papers is called STEC, and it's about space, time, energy, and consciousness. The foundation is that space and time are dual to each other, they complement each other, and in system theory you can see very neatly how that works. But you can also see that energy and consciousness are likewise duals of each other. When everybody looks at space and time, they look at three dimensions in space and one dimension in time. But with a deeper understanding, you see that the fourth virtual dimension in space has a complement in three virtual components in time. And so then you can see that there's a four factor in space and a four factor in time, together creating an eight factor in space-time, with four real components and four imaginary components, but they're asymmetrically positioned.
Right.
And when you look at energy and consciousness, you can see that there are four real components of the energy vector, which are basically known as the four fundamental forces of energy, which are actually four different forms of involvement in experience. And those are then the real components of the vector, and there are also four imaginary components of that same vector, which are the basis of the vector of consciousness. And on the forefront page of the website on Science of Life, I portrayed that in its flat representation as a 4x4 grid with two different colors, blue and yellow, and that there are, say, for space there is three components in the reals, one in the imaginary. For time there's one in the reals and three in the imaginary, but you can only see how they hang together when you see the four components in the energy vector, which is basically the knot between space and time. But that has meaning only in our experience when you combine that with the consciousness vector, which is purely imaginary or virtual. I needed that to be able to understand how cell division works and how in our body, in the process of cell dynamics, you see that information is interacting with matter, and that in fact the dynamic of consciousness, which is say the possibility to make complexes in dimensions in the same way as you have described for the school class program, that with tetrionics you can see how the simple elements create large constructs. And then from that perspective you can see that consciousness, coordination, coherence and gravity are actually the same principle from a dimensional point of view.
I would term them all as mass.
I realize that in your approach, which is focused on physics, mass is the logical way to do that. I realize that we need to complement that with an understanding of consciousness, which is the complement of mass. And then there is that relationship between consciousness and gravity. But that would be a separate story, which I would also like to compare notes on with you. Which is that, I've mentioned that at some other time, the principle of freedom of choice. And in physics, there is no freedom of choice, and in Science of Life, it is all based on freedom of choice. So maybe it's possible that at some point I can describe to you what I've been discovering about freedom of choice, and how that unfolds and how that connects everything from the other side, because I imagine that with a flip of the triangle, everything that you have described for physics using tetrionics, when you turn it upside down, applies for freedom of choice in the Science of Life. I said that that would be an exploration by itself. We have now gone to the backgrounds of the significance of gravity. And this is where I would like to work towards an ending of this recording session, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
We started with the question of gravity and the graviton. And you basically said, okay, this is where we actually have to think about it fundamentally differently. There is a way to bring together all of the equations and the formulations which science provides, but we have to understand that we cannot always work with the interpretations which they gave to it in one
part,
because the mathematics was created to sort of be able to make leaps in our understanding. But on the other hand, we see that in a physics it doesn't really match up really well. And the example comes back in mind of what we discussed earlier, the difference between the findings of Edison and Tesla, Let's formulate it like that.
Yeah.
Now, there is an other way to look at it all, but that other way only becomes visible if you see that we are dealing with the interplay in different dimensions.
Yeah.
And so you already show that in Tetrionics you were able to resolve many of these seeming conflicts, because you were able to show that they are the result of differences in perspective, differences in involvement. But once you change to that tetrahedron logic with the equilateral triangles as a basis, then a lot of it falls in place, and specifically in the perspective of gravity, what falls in place, that you can see that are in fact three different forces which come together. And once you understand that, you can start to understand that more plays a role, and we haven't really got into that at this moment.
Yeah.
But on the whole, you really pulled together the whole magic of tetrionics in unraveling this problem of understanding of gravity, and showed that when you use tetrionics, that conflict in interpretation disappears.
Yeah.
So, as before, I really thank you for playing along on these questions and these complete and extensive answers.
And that's fine. Always, I just hope I convey the answers.
Yeah.
In a clear manner.
I'd like to ask you to sort of close off this recording session by something which for you would hammer it in place.
I suppose for myself, gravity and gravitons and theory itself, the biggest challenge was obviously unifying and creating a quantum theory, relativistic theory of gravity. It's one of those things that, again, my blind faith in equilateral triangles and the necessity to apply it and see where it took me, because there's no point having a supposedly unified theory if it doesn't explain gravity. But like so many other parts of physics, as in chemistry, the quantum mechanics, the electricity, it all involved almost religiously following the equilateral triangle principle, seeing what it was telling me, and jettisoning, can't even say it, throwing away some of the most cherished ideas that I've been brought up with regarding how gravity works and things like that. It's really hard to convey what it's like when you're trying to find an answer like what I've expanded here on gravity, when the only resources available are what you've been taught and the existing mathematics and the existing physics, even with university lectures and such. It really does come down to being a bit of a blind faith process, where you really have to just make the models, understand the models and what it's telling you about mass and matter in order to discern what the truth is. When you do get there and your mind gets around the interaction of charge, mass and matter, suddenly what seems so complex and hopelessly complex just gels. And I'm sure that as we delve further into expanding on space and time, as well as topics like biology and consciousness itself, we're going to discover a huge amount more in the way of jettisoning old ideas and having to look at things in a whole new way as they really occur.
Yeah. Essentially, that is the change of a paradigm. While you were speaking, sort of remember that the power of the theory is that it can help understand what you did not yet understand. But when it no longer does so, a new theory is needed. You said that you just applied the theory and the understanding fell in place of things you didn't even know that the theory could cover.
The funny thing was, I quite often found myself in moments of days and weeks of struggling with something, and every time I found the right answer that worked and explained other things, it always turned out to be that the geometric model was giving me the answer. It was never anything that I sort of found from the mathematics or found by just trying to think it through. every time there was a breakthrough, like the idea of what atoms really look like or how gravity really works, what electricity is all about or what a photon looks like, it always comes back to the geometry giving me the answer. It wasn't a case of coming from any other root source. It was always the geometry, and it was always the simplest answer. Despite sometimes I'd rejected answers, I thought, no, that's too strange to be true. And sure enough, something else would reinforce the fact that it had to be this way. And then when you apply it and develop it, you suddenly see it making sense.
That's wonderful. And as you already explained, children can play with this and come to understand it.
And that's the exciting part.
And that's also probably what some people might need to do in order to be able to grasp what you've been explaining about gravity and the non-existence of the graviton. I suggest that here we close the recording session.
Okay.
And I thank you very much for bringing this all together. As usual, I'll come back to you after hanging up here to explore if we can do more.
Thank you.